Okay, so this will be our last presentation, and it'll be about 12, 15 minutes, and then we'll have at least 15 minutes for questions and discussion. John?
Okay. Thank you. Good morning, everyone. I hope you're enjoying the lovely San Diego weather. It's like 30 degrees in Boston right now, I think, where I'm from. So I'm John Sabro. I am a resident in internal medicine at the Mass General Hospital, and I'm going to present on a project I did while a medical student at NYU. Geography of primary care users of the Bellevue Emergency Department. And I did this project with my co-primary author, Arka Deb, who is a fourth-year medical student at NYU, and he's in the audience right here joining me, and we sort of flipped a coin to see who would do the presentation, but he'll help answer your tough and insightful questions at the end. Our disclosure statement, so he and I received financial support from our institution, NYU, through a public health scholars program that is funded in part by a grant from the Pfizer Foundation. So you've heard some background about non-urgent visits to the ER. It's a very important topic. National Hospital Ambulatory Medical Care Survey, looking at all the millions of data points that they have, estimates that about 50% of their ER visits are non-urgent. In some other surveys, it could be higher or lower numbers. There's a wealth of literature showing that non-urgent users of the ER are more likely to be poor and uninsured. And sort of the flip side of the situation is that a lot of these non-urgent users are possibly not receiving a continuous source of primary care. And the IOM 2002 report on uninsured patients in this country showed that continuous primary care is really optimum for health outcomes. And if you don't have a source of continuous primary care, you're likely to have worse health outcomes. So just two examples of studies that used geographical analysis to look at the situation in their ER is a study done by Lee in Baltimore. They didn't look at the situation from a non-urgent, urgent perspective, but they did try to see what trends existed in the geographical nature of Baltimore in terms of accessing emergency department use, and it seemed like heavy use was determined by race and housing tenure in their study. And Bagley et al. Did a study in Houston, Texas, gathering about 300,000 data points, actually. And what they did was try to correlate zip codes and whether or not that area was known to be medically underserved using the index of medical underservice that the federal government puts out. And they did find a correlation with non-urgent use and zip codes that are known to be medically underserved, according to the federal government's index. GIS, this audience is probably pretty familiar with it. It's used in infectious disease, surveillance of vector-borne diseases, quantifying environmental health hazards, predicting injury rates, all sorts of stuff. We just sort of took the incredible analytical tool of GIS and a short survey of emergency department house staff to see if we could identify communities that make disproportionately greater use of the Bellevue Emergency Department for non-urgent visits. And so our hypothesis would be that clusters of such non-urgent users may signify that that particular region or neighborhood is somehow lacking in a primary care resource. Or it might be, if we found a cluster, that they had a primary care resource, that they just didn't know about it or for some reason weren't using it. So what did we do? Our study population, Bellevue Hospital Emergency Department, is a huge public hospital run by the Health and Hospitals Corporation of New York City. It's staffed by the NYU School of Medicine. The ED department has urgent, pediatrics, and acute areas, and we included all in our study. Our study was done in over 2 years, 1 month in each year, and that was determined by the availability of research staff. It was done in August of 2006 and August of 2007. The data collection was done by our trained medical students between their first and second years. What they did was a chart review for demographic variables that we had predefined and attempted 100% capture of everybody coming in the ED. We had these medical students working overnight shifts. They worked every day, every night, which is what the life of a med student is. And the sort of key part of their data collection was an interview of the physician who had primary responsibility for the patient, whether it was a resident or an attending, to segment that particular case into an emergent or non-emergent definition. And the question that they asked them was, in your opinion, did this patient require care at the emergency room, or could he or she gone to an outpatient clinic? and we did an inter-rater reliability study using standard cases to see how much agreement there was on defining emergent versus non-emergent among that set of physicians. So the analysis was done using ArcGIS. We geocoded everything, put it on a coordinate map of New York. The non-urgent individuals served as our cases, and the urgent individuals were our controls. And spatial statistics were done using the SatScan program, which is an amazing free software program developed by the National Cancer Institute. It's a spatial scan statistic using an underlying Bernoulli model. Basically what it does is it starts at each case point, creates an ever-expanding circle, and tests the observed versus expected number of cases and controls using a binomial distribution, going up to a larger and larger circle until it gets about 50% of the sample. It's an amazing tool if you've ever used it. We also ran a logistic regression using Stata of particular demographic covariates to see if they influenced whether or not you became an urgent or a non-urgent case. Those covariates were gender, age, ethnicity, insurance status, and language. So our results, over these 2 months, we got 1,001 patients. About half were urgent and about half were non-urgent, so completely agreeing with the ambulatory care survey. Inter-rater reliability was great. Our kappa was 0.89. The scan statistic identified one significant cluster in the 2007 data set and one in a combined 2006-2007 data set. And I didn't put a bullet point up here, but our logistic regression over those covariates was null for all of them. So these are the neighborhoods that the program gave us. Let's see if I can use the pointer. So here in the 2007 data set, this is the p-value, 0.007. The cluster is centered at Ocean Parkway and Avenue M&L in Brooklyn, New York. 59 cases and 18 controls over an enormous area, unfortunately, 10-kilometer radius. That's about half of Brooklyn. And then in our combined data set analysis, pretty close by at 78th Street and 16th Avenue in Brooklyn, we had a significant cluster with 72 cases and 27 controls. And so the program actually gives you then a series of secondary clusters ranked by the next most significant p-value. And these were much tighter, a sort of 2-kilometer or 1-kilometer radius, but none of them were statistically significant at a 0.05 level. These are the maps we generated. So for those not familiar with New York geography, this is Manhattan. This is Brooklyn, Queens, Staten Island, and the Bronx up here. So our in the 2007 data set, this is our cluster centered in outer Brooklyn. And this is our secondary most likely cluster near Bellevue. Bellevue Hospital is located right about here. And this is our combined data set, and you'll see the clusters pretty close by. This is the significant one in Brooklyn. So there are a number of limitations to our study. Because we didn't have money to really fund a lot of research staff, we got a limited number of cases. 2 weeks in the summer of 2006 and 3 weeks in summer of 2007, just 1,001 patients. Other studies sort of in this vein that we had looked at use case numbers in the tens of thousands. We also did not get the address of origin. We got their home address, their address of residence. And so people coming to the ED may come from all sorts of places, right? They may be coming from work. They may be coming from a restaurant where they just eat a really bad meal or something like that. In thinking this through, we thought this was still pretty valid because if somebody's going to use the ED for a non-urgent reason, why wouldn't they go somewhere close to their actual home of residence where they're going to go home at night? So even though we weren't able to get where they were coming from at that moment, we still think this is a sort of useful litmus test. We had a lot of missing data on the demographic covariates. Those med students were pretty overworked, so they couldn't complete all the forms completely. And I think that missingness is sort of part of the reason why our logistic regression was likely completely null over all those variables. And then they did a great job of capturing addresses, but only 74% of them could be geocoded just because people give ER administrators sort of strange addresses that may not exist or are not in the GIS software that we had. We're still pretty pleased with some of the results of this study. The physicians appeared to be very reliable in labeling cases as either urgent or non-urgent. There was great agreement in the CAPA, and it's a very efficient way of doing things rather than having a retrospective panel review all of the cases. Our GIS findings showed that Bellevue is a very widely used hospital. People come from all over the city. You have urgent and non-urgent cases distributed throughout the city. We did find two clusters that were significant, but they're probably not really actionable on a sort of public health level because of the massive radius of 10 kilometers that they have. And again, sort of, I think that the take-home message is that even though we don't have actionable clusters that we can work on, that I think that this method shows some promise. It's pretty cheap to do. If we had more cases, I suspect that we could have powered the study better and gotten some granularity in defining some areas that the Department of Health could look at to enhance access to primary care. And so these are just our acknowledgments, and thank you very much for having us.
Okay. Thanks very much. We do have about 20 minutes for questions. I just want to make a comment from the New York geography end of it. That cluster in Brooklyn doesn't have really good hospital ER access. And, if you get into health advocates in New York City, they talk a lot about the maldistribution of hospitals. And most of the so-called better hospitals are teaching hospitals, and they're clustered in Manhattan. So a lot of people come up from Brooklyn to Manhattan. But the other, your secondary cluster, is like 10 blocks from Columbia Presbyterian. So I don't know why they're going to Bellevue. That's just weird. If they needed to go to a good teaching hospital ER, they should have gone to Columbia. But that's my comment. Anybody else want to? I told you I'm a hardcore New Yorker. That was my disclosure at the beginning. Any comments, questions on this? Yes, sir. The observation that led to the study was that there was a time cluster for these non-urgent ER visits. They were give or take 7 o'clock p.m. So what happens at 6 or 7 p.m.? The working parent who has the vehicle comes home from work. Now there's a vehicle. And then where do they go? They have to go to the ER because the clinic is closed. That was actually the hypothesis that we were looking at, and the data that show the two, there are a lot of striking things in the data, but two are that there was so much concern about a clinic being closed. That was one of the responses. I collapsed a lot of the responses into little bundles like scheduling, but the two frequent complaints were clinic closed when I needed it, and the doctor wasn't there, which is really a capacity issue. Where sometimes that's the impression that there wasn't full staff
when the clinic was open. Sometimes, you know, there's so few providers that it was possible to show up at a time when the doctor you needed to see, the type of doctor you needed to see wasn't there. And that's where you get into an impact of, that's kind of a buried HIPAA, because that, you know, technically that wouldn't be counted. You know, the fact that that provider exists means that affects the status in a way that says it's not a health professional shortage area, but it still is because they're not there at the time. So those were the two things that were coming up that even transportation to the health center would not help. Yes, sir.
I think in your initial presentation you talked about the availability of bus routes and hospitals, that there were hospitals that didn't have transportation routes to them. I wonder how much of that is by design. If hospitals locate specifically either before transportation systems had developed and had sort of politically structured things so we don't want the hospital or we don't as a bus stop so that people are coming in, or how much of that sort of evolved over time?
Yeah, because
you mentioned you looked into transportation.
Yeah, the question has to do with how did that evolve, that transportation systems don't get to where hospitals are. I don't know if it's by design, but it's really kind of demented design. It seems that you want to have transportation routes taking people where they need to go. But some hospitals, like Washington, D.C., for example, the metro is wonderful, but it's very circumscribed, and it's really built around taking people to business or taking people to, Rockville, Maryland, to go work at ARC or wherever. But it's not designed to get you to Children's National, and it may have to do with what the... I think Dallas, I don't know the Dallas Transit that well, but it's my understanding that it's really kind of circumscribed around business. And that just seems to be what transit designers sometimes were thinking about. And it's another example, if that's the case, and I'm kind of off the top of my head here, but if that's the case, that's another example of not putting these two disparate but not really issues together, which is transit access and health access.
You guys have anything you want to say about that? No?
Okay, next question. Yes?
I'm from Louisiana, although I'm a half New Yorker. And what I've been finding is that we have more and more FQHCs, federally qualified health centers, and in areas that we really need, in really rural areas. And so what we're feeling is, okay, the health is available, it's local, people can get to it. But what people aren't paying attention to is that they also add an administrative fee before a person ever gets to a sliding fee that's based on their income. And so what I'm seeing now is our legislators in the state are backing away, saying, oh, there's plenty of FQHCs in the area for the folks to use those. So we don't know why they're using the ER, but some of the administrative fees are up to $25, and the lowest is $10, and that's before the copay. And I can just tell you the people that we treat have no ability to get that kind of money. But it looks on paper like it's right there, and the physicians are there, and they've moved mostly all the primary care that used to happen free of charge in the public health unit out into FQHCs now, which is going to take Medicaid and all that. But if they can't pay that administrative fee, they can't come.
Yeah, I don't think those are federal 330s, or if they are, you have a real policy issue. Maybe a legal issue, because the FQHCs that are funded by federal 330 grants may not turn anybody away based on ability to pay.
Well, I think the board is allowed to set the administrative fee.
There's some fruitful policy discussion that we should have there. What Louisiana has done better than most states is to have a network of school-based health centers that also may not turn anybody away. Based on ability to pay, and they really are a large part of the safety net where, at least federal 330s, I mean, there probably are different types of community health centers, and there are also for-profit community health centers in the world, too, so I don't know specifically what the auspice, the corporate auspice of the...
I'm just saying that when you consider what some of the barriers is, that comes into account.
Yeah, absolutely. If nothing in this discussion of transportation should be understood as underplaying financial access, that's there too. Usually it's insurance, but copays have become a very, very significant
kind of issue, not only for access to a visit, but for the pharmaceuticals associated with the visit. Yes, sir. Oh, yeah, okay, yeah.
Hi. So one of the points I thought most interesting was actually, it would have been if you had asked it as a question, I would have picked the opposite as the answer, which was that folks who were speaking Spanish were less likely to, were better engaged with the service of getting transportation. And I was curious to know if you have any thoughts, so I understand it wasn't part of your design necessarily, as to perhaps different type of outreach that was engaging that population or different ways that they were hearing about the transportation that could have impacted that rate, since it really is contrary to much of what we see in this population in lots of other realms of healthcare.
Yes, I think you're exactly right, and you know, we were trying to extrapolate as to why that occurred, and you know, without really knowing it, you know, and from the valley standpoint, I think, you know, which is the Lower Rio Grande Valley in Texas, and from what a lot of people tell me too is that my wife is she does casework in Michigan now, she did it in Texas as well, that a lot of the Latino clients are just so happy to have someone to talk to, and that they really go out and try to get everything that they can possibly get. And again, you know, when someone like my wife says, you know, when she spends time with her Hispanic clients, that she spends, you know, 30 or 40 minutes with them, where the ones that were born here are kind of, you know, dismissive, and when she does her home visits, they're watching TV and ignoring her. and the other clients, you know, are listening and asking questions and send empanadas home with her. And so that's why, you know, I get to eat as well as I do sometimes. But I don't know. It's a fascinating question. And again, I think the other research that some of my colleagues had done at A&M sort of showed that same thing. Again, that the first generation, it really is the first generation, not necessarily those that are born here and speak Spanish, but the first generation, those that come here are the ones that really sort of seek those services out because they're happy and you know, perhaps if they come here to succeed and are excited about getting those. So, but certainly that's something that needs more thought and research, absolutely.
Yeah.
Something that I've never seen research on, but just in the last couple months, anecdotally, is I've noticed I'm a primary care person. I ask my clients, well, why'd you go to the ER for this if it doesn't sound urgent or emergent? And I do think those two are very different, urgent and emergent. But I didn't hear a difference.
Yeah, we asked more the urgent than the emergent.
Okay, but when I ask my clients why they go to the ER and not primary care, the comment that I get more from parents, but across the board, is I want the best, and everybody knows the emergency room are the smartest and best doctors. My guess is that's coming from our television. But seriously, if that's the perception, now is it just that's what I'm hearing, or is that really something legitimate? I don't know.
Yeah, just to repeat that for the sake of the recording. It's an interesting observation that perhaps people think that emergency room doctors are the best doctors because of, I guess you mean TV shows like ER or something like that. Yeah.
And so loud.
Well, General Hospital. Okay.
Roy?
Yes, sir.
I'll be developing a TV show called Community Health Center this year, so that'll rectify the problem. The question about the Mississippi situation, I didn't know, is there a legal barrier to relationship between the hospital and the community health center, or is there a history of partnerships or relationships between there to kind of staff, extend hours, those types of things? Is there like a reverse shuttle service? Is like, you know, once you triage somebody at the emergency room, say, wow, this is a really interesting problem. It's just not that complicated. We're going to take you to a special doctor that is right across the street and take them over there. Is there any type of relationship between them, or are they, you know, long-standing enemies and a feud across, you know, state route 23 or whatever?
So the question was whether or not there's a relationship between the hospital and the community health center. Basically by design of the project, there's some relationship, and Dr. Raymond, for example, working between the two. They do have, between the hospital and community health center, they have a program to share costs and so forth as relates to physicians. So there's a relationship, and they both saw studying this and figuring out some interventions as a win-win situation. However, history, as you indicated, does get in the way, and we find that with many of our hospital and emergency rooms and the community health centers in the region. We're actually starting a project now. We're on November 2nd. We'll be doing this data collection at a different hospital, and in January for four other places. And again, trying to partner with community health centers with those hospitals to develop something. And there definitely are some barriers. The hospital is certainly interested and excited about being able to divert non-urgent cases to the community health center. And they can do that during the day. The problem, though, again, comes in this after hours issue, which we could have presented some of that by hour, the analysis by time of day, which would make it more clear, definitely. What I've seen regionally is more and more potential that the hospital administrators and the community health centers are realizing that they could work together. In fact, I was recently in a meeting, I won't say which town, in the Delta, where a new administrator said in the meeting, I'm not worried about the past. We need to address this problem. And if that means that the community health center is helping us operate a clinic on our grounds, then so be it, which is a huge step forward in that particular community. I also wanted to address the previous point about emergency room doctors being kind of the best doctors. In some of our other research, one of the things that we've really identified in the region is the perception of nurses not being good providers, and that so many clinics rely on nurses who don't have enough doctors. And time again, as we've interviewed folks about access to healthcare, they have the perception that nurses cannot provide adequate care. And so I think that's a major issue.
Nurses or nurse practitioners, or did you delineate that?
Well, in both cases, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. We've been working with our School of Nursing to help address some of this problem and really work with a lot of the community organizations and nonprofits in the area, the community colleges, and even through our in program at Delta State because of that perception. And I think one of the challenges to get to the question you just asked about what type of nurse is that a lot of people don't understand the differences between different types of nurses.
Hey. Do we have any other questions, comments, thoughts? All right, then we're done. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Do you guys develop a paper on that yet?